Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Train Smart Move Well podcast. My name is Philip Jacobs and I'd like to welcome you on board and also thank you for giving me some of your precious time and listening to this episode where I have Andreas Lorentzen as my guest. Andreas is a physiotherapist from Copenhagen, Denmark, who I really appreciate and respect for what he's doing out there. And in this episode, it is all about pain. So we are doing our best to look at pain from a multifactorial perspective. So in the beginning, we talk a little bit about the definition and try and get a clear understanding of what actually pain is. And we figure out that pain is not necessarily always a sign of structural tissue damage, but sometimes it can even occur without any structural damage. We talk about pain in terms of how it can be affected and modulated by so many different factors, such as the central and the peripheral nervous system, but also certain social and lifestyle factors. We talk about the biopsychosocial model of pain and so many gazillion different aspects. And I must say, I really learned a lot more about pain and how to understand it for myself, but also how to navigate and help clients when they are dealing with pain. And I really think and I hope that you at home will also gain something from this episode. You will learn something and kind of develop a better skill set in terms of how to deal with pain whenever the next time in your life you are dealing with it. So without further ado, let's just get this started. Right, man. Your name?
My name is Andreas Lorentzen.
Your favorite movie?
Oh, that would be, for now, it would be Dune.
Dune. Born in?
1992, 10th of August.
Living in?
Copenhagen.
Andreas, what's your favorite color?
Orange.
Your hate exercise in the weight room?
Oh, that would be Bulgarian split squats.
I fucking hate them. A lot of exercise in the weight room.
Just a plain old regular high bar squat.
That's nice. Your last strength training was?
My last strength training was just doing plyometrics.
And when did it take place?
That was this Saturday.
This is what you were sore from, yeah?
No, that was from Sunday when I was at a Sunday jam in Copenhagen doing parkour. Okay.
Last question, what did you have for breakfast this morning?
Oh, these days I'm having plain old oatmeal because that's really fast when you have a daughter who's like wrecking everything in the morning. Now I'm just an oatmeal guy.
That's quick and efficient. That a way to go. Yeah. Andreas, welcome to Train Smart Move Well. It's a pleasure for me to have you on the podcast. And after you have bravely answered this rather random collection of questions, maybe tell us in a few sentences, who are you? What are you doing? And like, what is happening in your life right now?
Yes. Well, I'm a physiotherapist by profession. And then I have also taken a master's in physiotherapy. Mm-hmm. So I have a master's from Odense University, so the Southern University of Denmark. And then I've also been doing parkour for 15 years, which is where we actually know each other from.
Exactly.
So I started way back. And I've also been doing all kinds of martial arts, mainly Muay Thai and a little bit of Kung Fu. But my main interest these days in regards to physiotherapy is just, you know, movement as medicine and having, I have a big interest in understanding pain mechanisms and really just trying to understand where people are coming from and trying to help them either with injury or pain in the clinic. And mm-hmm. Right now I'm working at a clinic near Copenhagen, dealing with a lot of neurological patients, geriatric patients, which is like 65 years and above. I have the pleasure of also being able to work in a heated water basin, so like in a swimming pool, mm-hmm. which opens up a lot of different avenues for treating people and helping them. So yeah, that's and I live in a small flat in Copenhagen with my my girlfriend and my daughter of almost 1 year old.
1 year old, and she already attended one gathering.
Yes,
That's
she
too
already
shabby.
attended the gathering.
That's awesome. Andreas, pain and how to define pain, how to understand pain, and how to use it and work with it is definitely like the biggest chunk of our podcast episode today.
Yeah.
Before we dive into that, you yourself probably had a couple of injuries, and you yourself have been living and experiencing pain in numerous ways, I assume. Do you maybe want to tell us a couple of anecdotes or stories about how you first touch upon this topic and how it maybe developed into you being so interested and putting this as a major focus in for you personally and or your profession?
Yeah, sure. Well, let's just start with where I got the interest from, because I definitely have some personal experience with injury and pain. But way back when I was still studying physiotherapy, this was in like 2015, 14, I was really way into all kind of alternative treatments. And, you know, that would be acupuncture, all kinds of, you could call it energy stuff from the Kung Fu that I was doing. Kung Fu works a lot with the concept of Qi. And I was way into that, doing breath work, all this stuff. And I thought that posture was the most overlooked thing in society, and that everyone was having pain because they had a bad posture, and I could fix it with my hands, and I could realign people, and I could feel things. And then
oh,
at
that's
some
interesting.
point, I came from that. And then at some point on social media, actually, somebody challenged some of my, like in a comment section, somebody challenged me and was like throwing references in my face and were making very, very sound arguments. And suddenly I was feeling that I was on very thin ice, and that I couldn't really, like, all the arguments that I was making came from personal experience and belief. And then I started second guessing why I was doing what I was doing and how I was doing it. And then I got way into, like looking at evidence-based practice in physiotherapy.
Yeah,
and one of
before
the
we dive into that, because what you were just describing, I can definitely resonate with, when your entire belief system is just being ripped apart.
Yeah.
How did that make you feel? Like, was it just like, oh, okay, I see I probably took a wrong turn, I'm just going the other way? Or was it like tough for you to handle that? Because that's how it was for me when I've had that realization.
Yeah, so I guess you also had that queasy feeling in the stomach, and it's almost the definition of being cognitive dissonant. You know, the cognitive dissonance is almost a physical feeling of being like an unpleasantness from having your, like, the carpet ripped away from your vision, and just being like, oh, whoa, this is what it is, and like changing that paradigm. But yeah, I had a very uncomfortable feeling. It wasn't nice. Like, you have to do a lot of soul searching to realize that you were wrong on many points, and then you have to accept that from there on you can start looking for some more accurate answers and questions.
Yeah, totally. Just to give like one random and not so big example, but when I started studying in my bachelor's in sports science, I was definitely taught like this mechanical advantage in keeping your spine safe by lifting with a completely straight round, straight spine, and making sure that you don't go too much into lordosis and blah 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 and all that kind of stuff. And this is how you lift shit. And of course, that's also what I was preaching and practicing. And when the evidence came up that this might not be entirely true, it kind of it was quite tough to realize.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing. So being confronted with evidence, something like I did my master's thesis on what evidence-based practice within physiotherapy is, and how it's viewed by physiotherapists. And when you're confronted with evidence, you kind of have to take a stance on whether or not to take it in or throw it away. And that's there is just some things that you can't really throw away, because the data is so clear that it changes the whole picture about how mechanisms work. So for example, lifting with a rounded spine, maybe the mechanism from being injured lifting with a rounded spine is not because you're lifting with a rounded spine, but because you're exceeding your capability in that particular lift. And then there are many factors affecting that. And I had the same experience with pain, not just being, you know, biomedical, being something that's not just in your body and that you're feeling, but being that evidence coming out that there are actually many, many, many systems involved in pain, and people like neuroscientists coming forward, doing a lot of research, finding out that Lorimer Moseley is one of them. Just looking into how the brain works when subjected to pain, and just how people report on that experience, and just seeing the broad category of chronic pain sufferers and how they experience every day, and how their experiences affect their pain. That kind of the meeting with that data and that evidence kind of changed my whole perspective on what physiotherapy was, because
right.
It just made me realize I can't fix people. I can only help them.
Yeah, totally different role. You brought up one of the very important aspects that I would like to talk about in today's episode, which is like differentiating between, let's just call it, the old and the rather new model in terms of we maybe used to think of pain as always being correlated to structural damage. So
yeah,
my back hurts. Okay, I have a herniated disc, or I pulled a muscle here, that's why I have pain. Or my meniscs are torn apart, that's why my knee is hurting. Like, this is like the rather old school belief, I would say. I don't know, during the past 5 or 10 years or so, fairly new evidence is more looking at it from a different perspective, and is also looking at other aspects of pain. And then they call it the biopsychosocial model. So they say it's not only a particular structure in your body that can affect the way that you feel pain, that you experience pain. There's so many other layers to it. And I think you can maybe give us a better a definition and understanding as to what that actually is.
Yeah, definitely. The old model is based off, René Descartes, the French scientist and philosopher. He came up with the Cartesian model for pain, which is kind of he's doing a dichotomy between, you know, the body and the brain, or the soul, because he's way back from when people actually had a firm belief that there was a soul. So, you know, you have the brain, I don't know, the pain coming from the brain. So the pain being solely based in your body, and, you know, not something that's part of the experience. He was the first to suggest that pain basically came from the brain.
Yeah.
And this is way back when. And then you have the biopsychosocial model, which is, I think, maybe 20, 30 years old.
Oh, even that old, yeah.
Yeah, it's really, really old. And today, the definition of coming from IASP, which is the International Association for the Study of Pain, there is an updated definition of pain, which is an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with or resembling that associated with actual or potential tissue damage.
Okay. So let's scale it down. We have to repeat that, because it was even tough for me to understand. Go again.
So it's an unpleasant sensory or unpleasant sensory and emotional experience. So this takes into account the emotional part and the sensory part. Then if we bring it back to the biopsychosocial model, bio being the body, psycho being the psyche, the actual experience, the lived experience of you being you. And then the social part, which is how you experience yourself in regards to the world and how the world affects you. So right. People around you and the environment. So an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience this kind of encapsulates that whole biopsychosocial concept, and it's associated with or resembling that associated with. So it is directly linked to or just a semblance of what is actually happening when you have actual or potential tissue damage. Yeah. So you can have pain and not have any damage at all. And you can have pain that just resembles what it might be like if you had actual or potential damage.
Right.
So it this definition, even though it's short, is very, very broad.
Yeah, it's opening a lot of layers. Totally.
It's a lot of layers. And one of them is that pain is always a personal experience, and it's influenced to varying degrees by both biological, psychological, and social factors.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe that would be a good place to start, like giving some examples of what that could be in regards to pain.
Yes. Do you have something in your mind, or should we go with the four key points of the modern pain model?
We can go with the four key points. That would be a good place to start as well.
Yeah.
First
being that pain is a measure of damage.
Yeah. Pain is not an accurate measure of what is going on in tissue.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that the experience of pain is mediated on many layers. First of all, if we go back to the actual, twisting an ankle is probably the most understandable and relatable thing for a lot of people to relate to. So you twist an ankle, the swelling goes up, pain takes a couple of days, and then it kind of escalates after 24 hours. And then after maybe 2-3 days, it starts getting better. You can bear some weight on the foot, and the pain kind of gradually fades, and you can start using your foot even more. You can start to rehab it, and then the symptoms, the swelling goes down, so does the pain again, and you start regaining more and more function. So here there is a very, very descript and obvious source of pain. You twist your ankle swells.
Right.
So usually that, depending on what kind of structures are affected, that can maybe have some residual pain for maybe 2 or 3 months where you kind of actually feel it. By 3 months, if let's say you have a affected ligament, the remodeling will have kind of been done. We're still affecting how the fibers of the ligament is being layered, but and that can happen up to a year, but the pain should have subsided by then. But then imagine that you're still having pain in that ankle, but there are no obvious symptoms. The scans are not showing anything. So what can be the issue?
Exactly. So just to dive into it from a totally say newbie perspective, we know that your injury or the incident that made the injury happen, you twisting your ankle, is 3 months back, and the swelling has taken place. The swelling is gone now. And from a physiological perspective, in terms of structural alignment of collagen fibers in your ligament, everything is fine. So basically, one would say, okay, you're not injured anymore, aka you don't have pain. Yet there are still some cases where you do have pain. And now back to you.
Yeah. So you still have pain. Then there are many mediators. There are, for example, if you just take the nervous system, this famous, very famous physiotherapist, Lewis Gifford, he is one of the biggest proponents of actually understanding basic neurology and neurophysiology in regards to seeing what happens if we have something that is adaptive or maladaptive. And having pain after 3 months when the injury is healed, quote unquote, is a maladaptive response to an injury. So you kind of start looking at where in your system, being the nervous system, being the musculoskeletal system, where is something maladaptive happening? And you know, that can happen in between synapses, in between nerve cells. That would be in the periphery around the injury.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the nerves can be facilitated in a maladaptive way, sending nerve signals to the brain that there is something wrong, even though the injury might have actually been healed.
Yeah.
And then there are, you know, central mechanisms. That would be the central nervous system, like, you know, your brain. And your brain and how the central nervous system is regulated is very much affected by you as a person and how you relate to the situation that's happening. So let's say we have a run-of-the-mill runner who went out for a run and pretty fast didn't really have a big emotional reaction. It's just a recreational runner, was back up and running maybe after 4 weeks, just, you know, doing small jogs. It's not a big part of his or her life. But this runner was just, you know, we see them every day. They come in, have an injury, they do the exercises, they get better by themselves because they heal, and they just get on with their lives. They're really good copers.
Yeah.
And then there are the other people. Let's say it can be, let's just take an athlete, because that would just also make sense in this context. An athlete who has a competition coming. This is off season. You twist your ankle. You have your first match in 4 months or 2 months. And then, you know, you have a lot of things that's being put on your shoulders to get better. So
there's
you have
so
to
much
get
more
better
at
for
stake.
This.
Obviously.
Yeah, you have things at stake. So, and you have your whole identity as a person. Let's say it's a soccer match as the attacker, and you're really good with your right foot, and you twisted your left ankle, so you can't really kick from your standing leg. So, what are you supposed to do? What are you supposed to tell your teammates? You can't really attend training because you just hurt all the time. You wake up in pain every day. You just start getting more and more nervous, and then by month three, like everything should have healed, but you still have pain.
Hmm.
And this is a healthy person with no comorbidities like being overweight, cardiovascular disease, smoking, any of these things. So the way you experience your injury or your pain is also affecting the nervous system. So when we have a strong emotional reaction to something, we also affect how the nervous system is measuring what's going on.
I think that's so interesting, and also maybe even counterintuitive, because you might think, hey, this is an athlete, it's a sporty human being that does move, that does train on a daily basis, so they should be able to cope better. But because of what we just pointed out and how you said that there's more things at stake and how his entire life is entangled around his ankle working so he can do his sport or her sport, it's just such a greater thing for that person to be able to get back, and there's more pressure and so many more things that they have to cope with, as opposed to maybe the once a week runner that drinks a beer with his colleagues after work and is not really too worried about it.
Exactly. And it's the way that, you know, we the nervous system interprets, or we interpret, different situations. So is something dangerous or is it not?
Mm-hmm.
So a well-adaptive response would be, we can start moving again. The swelling has gone down. We regain function. We start moving again. The pain subsides. A maladaptive interpretation of what's going on would be somebody who, you know, catastrophizes. This is another word within the pain science concept, or just, you know, from psychology as well. Catastrophizing meaning that, you know, you start at A saying, I twisted my ankle, and then you end up at set, and it's, you know, I'm going to lose my house, my partner, my job, if I don't get my ankle working.
Hmm.
And that just turns the stress of the system up. You know, our sympathetic nervous system just goes into an overactive mode. Our nerve, we don't have pain fibers per se, but we have some specific fibers who are really good at delivering nociceptive signals, nosy being pain. So, you know, stretch, pressure, heat, chemical reactions from inflammation. These nerve fibers get, instead of getting inhibited from, you know, the parasympathetic nervous system, us calming down, doing our regular old activities, just having this balance between the parasympathetic and the sympathetic system, they just get facilitated.
Yeah.
So, you know, even though it's an emotional, anxious response, it's very much neurological at the same time. And I think that's a really big thing to remember, because a lot of physios also just throw away the biopsychosocial model by saying, yeah, but saying it's just an experience just takes away the whole body part. So how can we even deal with chronic pain? And then chronic pain starts to slowly make sense if you take in the concept of it's about dealing with the person and their relation to their own body and the pain, and how their system interprets and adapts to these things that are going on within the area that is painful.
Right, right. So we've learned that pain is a measure of damage sometimes, but not necessarily all the time. We've just learned that pain is modulated by a gazillion of things. We're now getting towards how time is also an important factor. Maybe we can put an emphasis on really putting the two against each other. Acute pain maybe at the beginning of when you twist your ankle versus when it actually develops into chronic type of pain. And my question also to you would be, from a physiological perspective, I guess the answer is yes, because you just talked about the different sensory nerves and everything. Is there, does something change physiologically, like when actually your acute pain should have vanished, but then it develops into chronic pain? So that would maybe be the second aspect. First of all, we maybe differentiate between what is acute pain and what is chronic pain.
Well, acute pain, it's hard, because the distinction is the literature is talking more about persistent pain now, which would be chronic pain per se, but persistent pain being something that just persists. We have different, you know, we have a lot of connections between our neurons in our body and in our nervous system. Some of these neurons that are also relating information about what's going on in, let's say, the twisted ankle again, are inherently dormant. But a person, you know, this is called central sensitization. So the fibers or the neurons that are the nerve endings that are actually trying to feel what's going on are getting bumped. Bombarded with, let's call it pain signals. It's not a pain signal per se, because it's an interpreted signal that results in pain. And this could be for pain from inflammation, for example, the swelling going up and the loss of space within the ankle because of all the edema that's going on there, and because of this. This barrage of synapses that's going on, some of these dormant cells, they can sort of switch on. And when they've switched on, they start facilitating even more pain signals. The bad thing about this is that it's very hard for them to go dormant again. They're not going to be dormant. And now they've kind of, you know, neurons that fire together, they wire together. Now they wired with all these others, very sensitive neurons or nerve endings that are relaying what's going on or trying to understand what's going on in the ankle. So when the pain stops being acute, when the inflammation has subsided and we start regaining function, and the pain persists, then sometimes and most of the time, it's a question of a lot of neuroplasticity that has happened during the period of pain. So our nervous system that's changed and is now more sensitive to a stimuli.
Okay, they're just prone and susceptible to interpret certain signals as pain.
Yeah, there are basically just more signals being sent every second.
Mm-hmm.
A normal movement like walking could start to be painful. This is called allodynia. So something that's not painful and is suddenly painful is called allodynia.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have hypersensitivity, which is like, you know, you go to an end rage, you just twisted your ankle, you go into dorsiflexion, have your knee travel beyond your toes. For many people, that can be uncomfortable, especially if you have a tight ankle. And then it's just more painful than it usually is. Mm-hmm. And I hope you can also see that this is a spectrum, because you like, for some people, this is a normal movement and it can be non-painful. And it's maybe not that uncomfortable, but suddenly it's very uncomfortable and it's painful. And for some people, it's standard uncomfortable, but now it's painful. So, but this is two very important concepts within, you know, understanding pain, that something's maladaptive. Normal movements are not painful, or regular movements that were uncomfortable before are now extremely painful. Hypersensitivity,
right? I have some personal anecdote to this, and this could maybe also used as a bridge for complexity and also expectation in terms of how our beliefs affect the experiences we're having of pain. Because you just talked about how certain movements or joint angles that we engage into can be not painful at some point, but eventually they are painful. And this is how it was for me a couple of years back after having followed through an intensive handstand coaching. So I was a bit of an idiot at that time, because I like increased my volume of my hands from 30 minutes per week all the way up to 120 or so. So it was just bananas. It ended up in me, after one day of training, I think I couldn't even lift my arms above my head, and it took me a really long time to recover from that. And I'm still not at 100%, but as close to being completely pain-free as I've ever been. So it's really going well, and it's nice. But I know now, also looking back, that simple movements, you know, just like being in the kitchen and then reaching for that last pot in the cabinet, or I don't know, being in the car driving the steering wheel and then reaching back to get my seatbelt on, like things like that, that are usually activities of daily living, and they do nothing to you. All of a sudden, because anything that's semi-related to having your hands above your head is now, creating you pain, even though from a structural perspective, nothing was wrong.
Yeah,
and I think because I trained myself to that. I know, okay, if I lift my hand up this way and if I turn my seatbelt on now, I will feel pain that I, actually felt pain probably even more than I could have if I told myself this might be okay. I'll be all right.
Yeah, that would be a case of you having some sensitization to just normal movements, right?
Mm.
And, you know, the thing about expectation is also, if we go back to like the neuroplasticity of the system and how neurons start wired together and they start getting excited. And then if we move on to expectations, we can have certain expectations of movements being painful. And then as soon as they are painful, we kind of just strengthen the connections between those neurons that have wired together and have been sensitized, and we get more anxious and we get more stressed, and the whole system itself is then reacting even more. It's kind of like a dimmer switch. We kind of just turn up the volume or the light, so everything is just bright and everything's just blasting, and we kind of have we don't have the ability to turn the dimmer switch off on those certain movements. So we have to work with expectation of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
If we just go one step back to time, let's say we exceeded the normal physiological healing of what's going on.
That's usually perfect, because I had the ambition to be back in 12 weeks. I was like, okay, yes, I'm going to give myself 3 months. And by that time, I want to be able to stand on my hands again. And of course, it did not work. So please continue.
Yeah. So usually time is very important, because as we exceed that limit, the relationship between what's going on in the tissue and what's and the relation to the actual pain that you feel is getting less predictable and more blurred.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that you're actually the mechanisms become more maladaptive. So you have bigger and bigger reactions personally to what's happening, and neurologically and physiologically to some very, very minute stimuli. So you were always, the tissue, after being injured, tissue will never be the same, because tissue healing works by scarring. So, tissue will heal, but it will look different and will feel different.
Mm.
That's just a fact. It can never be the same. So just that minute difference after healing can be a source of you feeling, you know, just moving that ankle or moving your shoulders after having this injury, having them feel different might be cause for concern, quote unquote, from your nervous system.
Yeah.
And then again, if we look at expectation, this also ties very much into the social part of pain, because now we've only talked about what's going on within the person. But if we start to add on, let's say that you had, I have no idea how your experience with your injury was. I'm just going to, you know, hypothesize here.
Please do.
So let's say that you read somewhere that this injury kind of looks like this, and you start looking at some people either on Instagram or read some articles about how to do it. And you kind of get an expectation of, like, if I follow this protocol, if I do these exercises, I will be at this point in the future. And that will probably be more pain-free than I am now. And then you start talking to people, and they start saying, yeah, you should do this, you should do that. And you start following their advice, and you kind of build up expectations. And you also say to them, I'm going to do this. So you kind of make a
commitment
to other people. So now they know that you're working with this, and they're kind of involved in your whole situation. This builds a lot of pressure, and you can have people. This is being at a family party. You're telling your uncle you have a painful shoulder, and then telling him, and then he's telling you, yeah, I had the same thing, and now I got an operation a year later. And you start worrying. So, you know, that's also part of the social aspect of pain. And this creates many expectations, and it can create worry and anxiety about what's going on. So it's basically dealing with expectations that are based in reality. That's one of the important things about dealing with pain. And usually that involves a lot of education on how pain mechanisms work, because then you start having different expectations to how your reality should look or can look at which point you're in. So let's say you still have pain after these 3 months, and you start worrying every time you reach for something in the cupboard, because you have this nagging, this itch, this small painful feeling in your shoulder, and you start worrying, oh, I'm creating more damage. And as soon as you start educating yourself on the fact that maybe you're not creating damage, and this is just my body sending me a signal that this is an uncomfortable situation that I'm not good at being in. So, or it could also be just you sleeping too little and your system being way sensitized, but you know, it's very complex. But as soon as you start educating yourself on the myriad of reasons why you can have pain without it causing more damage, you start to change your expectations. You start to worry less. You can start to move more. As soon as you start accepting that you can move with pain, it's also a game changer, because you can start facilitating some of these very important structural changes that you're not getting from being immobile and sedentary from having pain. So you know, having pain is an evil circle of creating immobility, sedentary people, and having them not move and having them not participate in the things that they love, which is a very, very big and important part of the social aspect of pain science, that participating in things that you love doing is like the best painkiller that you can have. Like you go dancing, you forget all about your pain because you're laughing and you're talking to people. Play petang. It's also a great painkiller because you're talking to people, you're out in the open, the sun is shining. And as soon as you start taking those activities away from people, like, you also create an expectation of, I'm never going to return to them because I have pain and this pain is keeping me from joining in.
Yeah, yeah. The worst example is, and I still think it's being practiced out here in some orthopedic houses in Germany, is when somebody has a herniated disc and then they get this we call it gelber Schein, like this yellow sheet of paper saying, okay, you're only supposed to lift 10 kg for the rest of your life from now on. It's horrible. And what you said about you know, educating yourself or someone else with pain and helping them to understand that pain might not be a dark passenger or a death cause, but more like a signal being sent to your body, is, I think, really important. And it's something I have more and more incorporated in my work also with my PT clients. And it's such a powerful tool when people, and also I myself, learned that, hey, this is my body telling me right now at this moment, it's not a good situation, or my current capacity is not ready for that movement. Mm-hmm. That being said, it's not forever. I might just still not be there and have to take a step back and work within a different range of motion or with less load or in a different angle and whatsoever and what so forth. But I can create like my personal comfort zone. I'm going to work in that. I experience movement and I collect positive experiences. And I gain self-confidence. And then slowly, step by step by step. And there's a wonderful paper by Jill Cook, how it's about increasing your capacity step by step. And this is basically rehabilitation of every musculoskeletal injury that you have.
Yeah.
Is what you have to do. And if you are able to hit that fine line in terms of increasing your capacity to the extent that you want it to be, whether that be, again, running or playing football, or just playing petang with your buddies, then that's where you want to be.
Exactly. And I think, you hit the nail on creating positive experiences, because that's, I think, for me in physiotherapy, that's the most important part for me. I want to have a physiotherapeutic lens on why I do exercises or why I have patients do things, but I mainly just want to create positive experiences. Because if I only have them 30 minutes a week, I need those 30 minutes to be enjoyable.
Right.
I need those 30 minutes to be something that they remember, and just remember that one thing that I said that made them smile in relation to how their body works or how their pain works.
Yeah.
And what you described before was, like, you know, the basic concept of graded exposure.
Exactly.
And I think
exposure to movement.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that concept is being used too much on just, you know, the mechanical pain stuff and leaving out the person. So if we start looking at how do we create new positive experiences, usually that is also coming from changing expectations. So in psychology, this is called expectancy violation. So you violate an expectancy, meaning that you have an expectation of having knee pain whenever you squat. But if we just change the load a little bit, the intensity, the volume, the angle which your knees are in, maybe we put something underneath your heels so we can have those knees travel even further, and you can lift and have less pain or no pain. That is in and of itself an expectancy violation, but it also kind of grates the person into a perspective of, well, I can actually start moving and feeling for myself. I can take ownership mm-hmm. of what I'm doing if I just follow these concepts of trying to move into pain in a somewhat graded manner. You know, it's a lot about having a flexible mind in many ways when you start to learn about pain. But I think it's very important that we use graded exposure on people and use it to create positive experiences, as you said.
Yeah, 100%. On that note of complexity and expectation, and then you mm-hmm. having said within those 30 minutes that I see them once a week, I want them to put a smile on their face after the session and they should have a positive experience. Maybe contrary to that, sometimes it might even be necessary to work with pain in a mm-hmm. certain pathology. So for me personally, patellotendinopathy is one thing that I really looked a lot into. I've had it myself. I wrote my master thesis about it. I'm working with quite some people that are having it. And then one of the first things that I tell them is that it is okay to work within pain as long as it's not succeeding a certain threshold.
Yeah.
And this kind of goes towards another aspect that I wanted to talk with you about, which is accepting pain. We don't have to be super specific and talk about pain and exercise and patella tendinopathy, but maybe more general for you, Andreas. How do you talk to people about also embracing that you have pain at this moment?
Yeah, it's very hard, because when you speak to people who are living with pain every day, and you mm-hmm. come as a person, a physiotherapist, and you can't just tell them you have to accept your situation.
All right.
I think it's an issue of just teaching or going into a dialogue with people about, you know, instead of trying to eliminate pain, we have to go towards a goal of living a fulfilling and satisfying life, and not having that pain stop us. And that the goal for the partnership that you go into when you have a patient or a client should be towards that being a satisfying and fulfilling life, and not the elimination of pain. Because as soon as you start having the positive as a focus, you know, the fulfilling life, mm-hmm. being able to reach your goals, you automatically, as again, start creating positive experiences. As soon as, of course, as long as you're good at coaching and you don't just give people a lot of experiences where they fail.
Yeah.
But instead of having that pain as a focus and start focusing on the other things, you have to accept the fact that in that process you have pain. So you have to kind of accept the reality of pain itself. And, you know, going back to the neurophysiology of the pain, by doing that, we can decrease the acute pain intensity. And what's going on in the nervous system is that we start inhibiting some of these very active pain fibers.
Mm-hmm.
So we start having all the cells that were firing at a high rate, all the neurons, we start inhibiting those.
Yeah,
we start using our own morphine system, you know, the endogenous system. We actually have endogenous painkillers that we can activate by doing things that activate the parasympathetic nervous system as well. One being accepting the life you're in. I would be remiss if I said that I knew the exact mechanism between accepting pain and an acute pain going down. I don't know it, but there is some sort of comfort or wellness aspect to accepting the state you're in, instead of being stressed, which is again activating the sympathetic nervous system even more.
Yeah,
and creating again, higher levels of pain.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it again resonates with me. Also on that note that you brought up with regards to, hey, it is not that easy for me as a physiotherapist to tell my patient that lives in pain 24/7 to just accept it. But then on the other end also, I remember I was last year I was working for a full year with a coach. Actually, he's from Denmark, and one of my main aims for our cooperation was to get rid of shoulder pain. Said I want to get back to having no pain at all, not necessarily to stand on my hands again for 2 hours a week, but you know, I want to be pain free, and that's how we started. And we had calls every 4 to 8 weeks, and at some point he even dropped the line, maybe Philip, it's also okay not to be in complete pain-free state. Yeah. Maybe it's okay if your shoulders hurt. And I was like, are you fucking crazy? What the fuck are you talking about? This is why I'm working with you. I want you to get me away from pain. But that sentence, it ignited a lot of thoughts in me afterwards. And I was mad at him for, I think, 2 days. A couple of weeks later, upon a bit more of reflection and me having this in my mind, it kind of changed this black or white attitude. It changed this. It's either this or that. And it went more towards what you described earlier as maybe it's okay to rather aim for living a fulfilling life where you can do what you want to do and building up on that. And then it's really nice that I, looking back, could see myself developing more towards that end of the spectrum. And I'm still like very keen on, you know, getting back on my hands and doing things that I couldn't be doing half a year back, and it's going well, but it's more like I'm more open to still have pain in half a year or in a year in certain movements. So for example, right now I can't really do a lot of swings, or one arm hanging is still a problem. And that's okay. And I might never get back to being one arm hanging absolutely pain free or swinging, but I will try. And if it works, it's super nice. And if not, then that's also okay, because there's so many other things that I can do. It's not that my life is dependent on it.
No, and I think that's a really, really healthy way to approach it. And I think it's about having possibilities as well. Not, you know, if you start hanging your hat on your ability to be able to hang in one or two hands and doing swings, then as soon as you can't do that, your whole identity just kind of falls apart. Your identity as a mover kind of just, you know, doesn't sync with the reality that you're in.
Yeah.
And I think for many people living with persistent pain, pain becomes part of their identity. I am a person who has pain, and therefore I cannot do XYZ, and I do all these other things to cope with my pain all day. So, you know, pain becomes an integral part of your everyday and your identity. And I think that's a dangerous place to go, because these kinds of identification with pain, or
it's
having
horrible.
Yeah.
And let's take an extra pause to the listeners. I just want to repeat this three times. You are not your MRI diagnosis.
No.
You are not your MRI diagnosis. One more time. You are not your MRI diagnosis. Please continue.
Yeah, definitely not. And the reason why this is so important is because that these kinds of feelings and thoughts, they can actually lead to depression and anxiety.
Yeah.
And depression and anxiety is not going to help you get out of pain. So we want to have people being mentally healthy as well. And that has something to do again with acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a basic concept within psychology. And I'm not a psychologist, but you know, just being able to accept reality as it is gives you more possibilities of living, because you start seeing things for what they are instead of wishing for what they could be. And that kind of opens up a lot of roads to recovery as well. As you just said, there are plenty of other things that I can do, and it's okay if I don't swing or if I hang, because these things are definitely something that could add value to my life, but there are a lot of other things that definitely adds value. And just having that attitude is having an effect on pain in a positive way, which is the crazy part. But having people go into that mindset, that's really, really hard. And it takes reflection and it takes personal growth and it takes a lot of introspection as well. If you're as you were on the black and white side of things.
Yeah, for sure. And like I said, it didn't change overnight. It took me a couple of weeks to get to that point, for sure. Okay. Awesome. Maybe because I feel like all my very important bullet points we have touched upon. If there's nothing left for you that you feel like this is urgent, I want to get this out there, maybe we can try to conclude this and talk a little bit more about gradual exposure. And I'm also happy for you if you want to share. Maybe it sounds tacky, but if there's like a top three tips or like, hey, this is an approach I like to give out to my patients when they start out with me, maybe this could help our listeners that are potentially currently dealing with pain. Would you want to go down that road?
Yeah, sure. I'm a very big proponent of what you would call auto-regulation. Yeah. So being able to regulate yourself in the environment that you're in. One thing I always teach my patients is how they should relate to pain, because I really want to see patients as little as possible. Mm-hmm. For different reasons, it's taxing on them economically and it's taxing on them when they have to spend their time with me and traveling, and they also have to relate to what I'm saying. So I want to get people out and doing living their life when they're as soon as possible, and that's when they're comfortable. So what I usually start teaching them in order to become comfortable is how to auto-regulate your activities when you have pain.
Yeah.
So as I said, you have adaptive and maladaptive pain, and adaptive pain is the good kind of pain. That's when you do too much, you have swelling, and there's a reaction in the tissue. So let's say you have knee pain, and I tell you to do things, try getting back into exercise, do the exercises you love, watch out with how much you load. What you should usually watch out for is if you have pain during, that's okay. You shouldn't go higher on a scale from 0 to 10, 10 being the highest and 0 being the lowest, 10 being, you know, burning nails through your hands, and 0 being no pain at all. You shouldn't go higher than 6 on a scale from 0 to 10. Mm. 6 being the, and you know, this is an elastic, 6 being the max. You should be around 4 or 5 if you have pain. And then that's okay. If the pain has not subsided after 2 or 2.5 hours after you trained, then you've done too much.
Right.
And if you wake up in the morning having, you know, this stiff feeling in your knee, having swelling. Swelling is also after you train. If you have that, you've done too much. But the important part here is not to, you know, throw away the exercise that you were doing, but it's to scale it back. So minimize the load again, try different sets and rep schemes. Try not running before you go squatting. Maybe cycling would be a better possibility, so you don't have as much reactive load when you run. So, you know, just scaling it back, auto-regulating, even though you have pain, that's probably one of the best tips that I can give to people.
Yeah, I love that. Sorry, finish your sentence, please, and then I have something to add.
It just opens up a lot of avenues for people to just go do stuff without having somebody to supervise them all the time.
Yes, 100%. And it's so nice when you can teach this this skill of, okay, I did something, it cost me pain, that did not subside within a couple of hours, and it even stayed until the day after. That doesn't necessarily mean that whatever I did is good or bad. It might have just been a little bit too much. So what things can you do to modify it? The duration that you expose yourself to that activity, the intensity in terms of how much weight you put on that bar, if you're lifting, maybe the volume overall was too much. Yeah. If you're used to running 20K a week, but at the moment your knee is suffering from just, you know, too much, maybe you have to do 2 times 8 kilometers or even less. Yeah. So it is up to us at that point in time to understand it and then work within it and downscale to whatever extent that I have to do, I feel like. And once you understand this concept, it's a very powerful tool and skill to have.
Yeah. And there it comes, of course, with a caveat, which is this is from the premise that we've been teaching people how to exercise, or that people have the needed experience to be actually able to do exercise at all.
Yes.
And knowing about, you know, you have to recuperate and rejuvenate. So you have to have enough calories. You have to have sleep, all these kinds of things. So once we check all the basic boxes, this would be one of the main ways to auto-regulate, I think.
Yeah, 100%. Awesome.
Yeah.
Andreas, thank you so much for this. I think we've done enough for the the theoretical part and all this professional part about pain. Maybe we finish up with our personal questions, and then we have a little bit of jibber-jabber at the end, and then this is
yeah,
it.
Yeah, sure.
Do you want to start?
Yeah, I was thinking about which kind of books you were reading these days that are fictional.
Fictional, I think.
If you're actually reading
to disappoint
books.
You on this one, I haven't. Oh, actually, I have. Yeah, it's semi-fictional. The last semi-fictional book that I read is a story of a woman that grew up in the DDR in the 1960s, and then she and her parents, they flew into West Germany, and it is kind of based on a true story. And the author that wrote the book was talking to her a lot, but he made it a little more like fictional in that sense. So that's why I'm saying it's a semi-fictional book. But that is as close as it gets. I'm afraid at the moment I'm reading a lot of books about personal development, and the one that I'm reading right now, which goes a little in that direction, is Let My People Go Surfing. From the CEO.
I love that title.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's from the CEO of Patagonia, the clothing brand.
Oh, nice.
I forgot the name of the guy, actually. I think he's Eve or something. Anyways, that's the book that I'm reading, and it's about his story of how he actually just wanted to go surfing and climbing all the time, but eventually at the same time came up with this huge brand of Patagonia, and how he was always focusing on it. At least he tried to make it as sustainable as possible. And, the brand and the company belongs to the planet and not to me and not to capitalism whatsoever. I've only gotten to the first chapter so far, but as of now, it was a nice read.
I could imagine that it would be captivating reading a book by the founder of Patagonia. It would be very inspiring.
For sure, for sure. Okay, Andreas, I have a very short one for you.
Yes.
Do you get up immediately, or do you snooze in the morning
when the alarm rings? Is snooze defined as I'm hitting the snooze button, or is it just, waiting 5 minutes?
I would define it as hitting the snooze button, actually.
Okay, then I get up.
Then you get up. So
yeah.
That means you don't hit the snooze button, but you take a couple of minutes in bed before you...
Yeah, there's an old Zen saying that when you wake up, you wake up. So I just try to wake up, because that's what I'm doing.
I'll try that tomorrow morning, because I'm a horrible snoozing person. But I'll try. Okay, man. Thank you so much for the time that you gave me and our listeners, who hopefully can take something out of this episode. Any last words, Andreas, that you want to get out there, please do so. And also, please, if you want to, let our listeners know where they can find you to, ask you questions and look at your content and whatever they want to
do. The basic feeling I want people to be left with is that pain is always personal, and if you are a person in pain, and you're not capable of dealing with it yourself, it is always, almost always, the right decision to go looking for help, and go looking for help with people who are empathetic and have sympathy for your situation. And of course, people who are professional. So don't go looking for snake oil salesmen. But if you have pain, get some help. That's my that's probably my main message, because too many people are in pain and not getting the help they need.
That's beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah. And if people want to go see what I'm doing, that's mainly parkour and some physiotherapy stuff. It's you can follow me at on Instagram on my handle, Jumping Physio, and that's JUMPIN Physio.
I will make sure to put that in the show notes.
Sure. Perfect. All right.
Awesome. Andreas, thank you. And thank you also to all of our listeners. And I'm looking forward to hearing you back soon. And until then, train smart and move well.